You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. Check out our website at thetakeaway.org. You'll find other interesting stories, quizzes, and behind-the-scenes photos and videos.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for being with us. And look around your home or office right now. Is there someone who, at whatever age, seems to be stuck in a perpetual adolescence? Teenage years didn't end with the ones or even the 20s. As life lengthens, the passages of life also stretch out from the golden years back through middle age and the teen years, which apparently aren't just for teens anymore. Our discussion of the deeper implications of people living longer continues with a look at economics and a fascinating look at how and why teenage culture was invented in the 20th century. Also, the question of Crimea's secession from Ukraine. Can an entire country ask for political asylum, essentially defect to Russia? But a business story tops this hour, the collective economic clout of thousands of small-time operations adding up to a multi-billion dollar trade that takes advantage of some of the newest technology to deliver one of the oldest services in the service economy.
Down at the Chicken Ranch, where a lonely girl could have a chance and a hungry boy could find romance at the Chicken Ranch.
The sex trade is playfully joked about, as in the 1982 musical, The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, Dolly Parton singing there. It is studied, as in this 1983 documentary.
If you wanted the VIP room, which we have the waterbed, the jacuzzi, the passion chair, which everybody really likes.
That's from the Nick Broomfield film, Chicken Ranch, which profiled $1,000 VIP rooms, private call girl planes, and very cut-rate $60 an hour sessions at a legal house of prostitution in Nevada. The sex trade is also tolerated and flourishing in our time. The Department of Justice conducted a first-ever detailed analysis of the state of the business in 2007 in 8 cities. The sex trade may be lucrative in the internet age, but it is still largely local. 2 voices to talk about this now. Robert Kolker is the author of Lost Girls, an Unsolved American Mystery, and an editor at New York Magazine.
Hi.
Also with us is former sex worker Melissa Gira Grant, a journalist covering the sex trade, author of Playing the Whore, The Work of Sex Work. Melissa, welcome.
Thanks.
So looking at this story, Robert, let's just begin with kind of the macro picture here. Economically speaking, is this a fundamentally different business in 2007 than it would have been a decade before or even, a generation before?
I think it is fundamentally different. I think it's as different as the book industry it was over the last 10 years. The internet has disrupted sex work, in my opinion, almost as substantially. And there are a lot of people who aren't walking the street anymore, who aren't working with a pimp anymore, aren't working with an escort service anymore, are just using the internet, Backpage or formerly Craigslist, to be solo practitioners and freelancers.
It seems as though the solo practitioner segment of the business has burgeoned because the report seems to suggest that pimps are, alive and well in 2007. What explains the granularity in this report? Why Denver would have a $40 million business and Atlanta, for some reason, has a $290 million per year sex trade business?
Well, I think that a lot of people over the years have been concerned about trafficking, and there's been a lot of conversation about trafficking, and the Justice Department is probably to be commended for wanting to do a study that tries to get, to drill down and figure out exactly what is happening in the way of trafficking in different cities, and it doesn't surprise me that different localities would be different from one another. But I think they are ignoring a substantial change that's happening, which is, that anyone new who might be getting into the business, if they're not being trafficked or coerced, is probably doing it on their own. And this study, to the extent that I've read it, seems to focus more on pimps than on, the high-end escort services or the freelancers.
The experience of being a sex trade worker, Melissa, do you think that's changed, that the actual job description itself has changed in 2007 compared with a decade ago or a generation ago?
I think it's changed quite a bit, but I also think that our ability to understand it has changed a lot, right? Like, it's pretty telling that this is the moment when the Department of Justice is interested in investigating this. And we can't forget that the mandate in putting this study together was to investigate trafficking. So it doesn't surprise me looking at their request for proposals, who they chose to talk to, and how they chose to solicit participants into the study, and why that meant that they didn't get to talk to freelance practitioners. They didn't get to talk to the kinds of people in the sex trade who work independently, who are unlikely to come into contact with law enforcement. So they're getting a very skewed picture of the business that doesn't even itself fully represent how many more people are working on their own, how many more people are using the internet to take charge of their work.
One of the things the report does show is that there's a perception within the trade, or at least the people that they looked at, of where law enforcement is likely to grab you and where law enforcement is likely to look the other way. Do you think there's an expectation among sex trade workers that if you stay away from minors, you're fine? If you stay out of the sort of coercion elements, you're also fine? That there's a toleration of the sort of freelance sex trade where there is not a toleration of the coerced sex trade or trade involving minors?
I've never heard conversations like that, to be honest, among any of the sex workers that I've interviewed or anybody involved in the sex trade. The kinds of things I hear when people are talking about where they're fearful of having an interaction with law enforcement that could result in them getting imprisoned is people who are concerned that they're being targeted based on their race, based on their gender, and based on where they work. So, you know, the sex industry, like every industry, is stratified. And there are people who have a lot of resources and can run their own businesses. And then there are people who are just scrapping by, living hand to mouth. You know, it, in some ways, we want to think that the internet is what's changed policing and sex work, that the internet is why, you know, police are so focused on the street. But part of the reason so many people moved onto the internet is because the police were so focused on the street, and that made the street a dangerous place for people to work. So, you know, that's something that's almost totally absent from the study. And it's not surprising that the study can't report itself on how criminalization actually shapes the sex industry, how where the police are more apt to police shapes the sex industry. And in some ways, the total failure of that, like looking at the recommendations, which are to increase policing, to use police crackdowns even more to go after other parts of the sex trade. You know, I think that it would have been interesting to say, well, here's how those kinds of tactics have actually failed people and put them at risk.
Is your recommendation legalization?
No, I wouldn't recommend legalization. I would recommend listening to sex workers. You know, it's appalling that a study that got this kind of funding was only able to locate 36 sex workers. I was just joking with Bob that we've probably talked to more ourselves in the course of just a year or two of reporting.
Robert, looking at the sort of conclusions of this study, they seem to suggest that everything involving minors is fine, that there's been an effective law enforcement crackdown on trade in minors, and that seems to have been in some sort of recession right now.
Well, that's refreshing news, because I think when people talk about trafficking, they assume the same way a generation or two ago people were fascinated by the idea of white slavery rings, you know, that there were swaths of underage victims being scooped up and taken away. It's a common, I don't want to say myth, but a common, you know, paradigm in our society, and we kind of buy into it generation to generation, thinking that there are people out there being victimized and we have to save them. I think there's a gray area, obviously, in commercial sex work. As Melissa said, it's a stratified industry, and a lot of people do it for a lot of different reasons.
But is the Department of Justice focusing here? I mean, is this study a precursor for the Department of Justice really focusing on the coercive side of the trade? And are there any insights in this report that suggest what the next steps might be?
I think the focus remains for them on trafficking, even though they can't quantify the problem. And even if they think there are fewer underage workers in it now, they don't seem interested in widening their lens and looking anything beyond, you know, the idea of coercion and trafficking and perhaps even underage workers. They're going to turn the other way most of the time in other cases.
To both of you, and, you know, sort of generally speaking, as we conclude here, they chose 2007 to look, which is kind of interesting. They didn't know that there was a recession looming. If we were to fast forward through, you know, from 2007 to now, how do you think the economic changes in the United States have affected the sex trade? And what would you see on the street as a result of the recession and coming out of it, Melissa?
I think one of the factors when we're comparing what we see on the street versus what most people don't get to see unless they're in front of their computer and looking at escort ads, right, and sort of imagining what those ads mean for how many sex workers are working or how the business is, you know, sex work has moved indoors and gentrified and privatized, right? That's happened even more so over those last few years. People who never would consider themselves someone who would go solicit a customer on the street and do sex work in that way have access through the internet to freelance as a sex worker in the way that lots of people who are facing economic pressures are patching together their income from multiple jobs. So, you know, that's one of the most dramatic changes I've seen, is that somebody who, you know, might not ever intend to do this for a long time can, you know, put an ad up and do a little bit of work here and there if they need to just make the difference between now and the end of the month to pay their rent. And I think that that's actually quite a different idea of what sex work looks like than most people are used to, that this really is something that people could do occasionally and casually. It doesn't identify who they are. It doesn't make them a criminal. It doesn't make them a victim. It really is a way to earn an income in a really tough time.
Do you buy that argument, Robert? This is a make extra dough on the internet kind of an approach to the sex trade?
Well, more than ever, I think that is the case. I mean, this study was commissioned in 2007, and in 2009, something like 30 different attorneys general around the country got together and called Craigslist the new Times Square. So I think if this study were commissioned a couple years later, it may not have been focused on the things it was focused on.
Nobody even knows the old Times Square anymore. It looks like a Disney theme park, but that's an interesting reference. Robert Kolker is the author of Lost Girls, an Unsolved American Mystery, and editor at New York Magazine. And Melissa Jira Grant, author of Playing the Whore, The Work of Sex Work. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So here's a discussion we've been having all week. If the golden years get longer, 3 or 4 decades instead of less than one, other passages in life may just slow down or maybe stretch out.
My core values and beliefs kind of were crystallized when I was a teenager. Making this film helped me realize how formative that period was in terms of my own ideology.
Filmmaker Matt Wolff became who he is as a teenager, he says, but he also believes that our society's identity is defined by the invention of teenage culture back in the 20th century. Wolff explores that in his new film Teenage, and we'll talk with him later this hour. But were they tough, your teenage years? From Woodbridge, New Jersey, as a fresh-off-the-boat Latino kid living in the Queensbridge Projects in Queens, New York, with a drug dealer dad, Bloods, gang members on every corner, hyper-vigilant and aggressive police everywhere, and a community that expected me to fail in life, those years helped me to define who I did not want to be. Today I live in Hilo, Hawaii, and I'm a coordinator for one of the academic programs at a local college. My teen years told me exactly who I was not. From Austin, Texas, I was a weird kid, only child, annoyingly precocious. The school bullies never let up all 12 years, but they never got to me either. It gave me my resilient nature. I left high school, joined the military, and suddenly I was this weird, petite, Hispanic female in a room full of intelligent, confident, white Air Force men. I had to be resilient then, too.
Hi, my name is John. I'm calling from Rhode Island. My teenage years made me who I am today because I was molested as a kid, which, among other things, started me drinking a lot. I then became an alcoholic, and that was actually good because at 30 I got sober, and that set me on the path I'm at today, which is basically trying to be the best person I can be. Trying to stay sober keeps you at one with the universe and all other people.
Kind of a get-me-out-of-there memory of his teenage years. Thanks for that story, John. From Pendleton, Oregon, for me, the teenage years did nothing to define me today. I would say my 30s and 40s are more of what defined me. Austin, Texas, I was a teenager during the explosion of the AIDS epidemic. Not a good time to discover I was gay. Nostalgia from Grand Prairie, Texas. Grew up in the late 60s, early 70s. Make peace, not war, free love. I think tolerance and acceptance of others was something I grew up with and has helped shape me into the 60-year-old person I am today. How did your teen years shape you? You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Join the conversation at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Matt Wolff on the invention of teenage culture later this hour. But coming up, is Crimea seceding or being snatched from Ukraine illegally by Russia?
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
We go to the crisis in Ukraine now. Three players, Crimea, Russia, and of course, Ukraine. And it would appear at this moment it is Ukraine that has the weakest hand right now. Here's Ukraine Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk in Washington yesterday saying that Ukraine has the high moral ground compared to Moscow.
Only President Putin knows about Russians' intentions. But we believe that we need to fix this crisis only in a peaceful manner, using all political and diplomatic tools. And Russia is to respect an international law and to stick to its international obligations.
Ukrainian Prime Minister Yatsenyuk there speaking to Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick yesterday down in Washington, D.C. But it is the people of Crimea who will play first here in an international crisis that is no game. With over 15,000 Russian soldiers on guard in Crimea, on Sunday, Crimeans will vote on whether to reunite with Russia or remain part of Ukraine. Is this secession, kind of like the old U.S. Civil War? Is it a violation of international law? Is it a democracy gambit being played by puppeteers from Moscow? Tom Ginsberg joins us. He's a professor of international law at the University of Chicago. Professor, welcome.
Nice to be here.
Let's start with the fact, the first sort of international legal fact here. The Ukrainian Constitution says there can be no alterations of the Ukraine map, the borders, that sort of thing, without unanimous consent of everyone in Ukraine or some referendum that is nationwide in Ukraine. How much standing does that constitutional provision have as Crimeans go to the polls on Sunday?
Well, it has a lot of standing for the internal law of the Ukraine and thus for other states as they're figuring out what to do in reaction to whatever the Crimeans go ahead and do. If the Crimeans declare independence, you know, the fact that that's illegal under the Constitution of Ukraine is probably going to shape the reaction to that declaration of independence.
Legally speaking, if you have a treaty with Ukraine, you therefore accept its constitution and would have to then declare this vote by the Crimeans illegal and oppose it as such.
Well, it's not a matter of having a treaty with the Ukraine. It's just a matter of how states react. So it's a kind of funny area. We do have examples of successful secession movements that have occurred around the world. And then we have examples of ones that have not succeeded, secessions that didn't succeed. And what's the difference? Well, the real difference comes to how other states react. If other states recognize you as a new state, then in fact and actually in law, you are a new state if you're recognized by enough of them. But without that, then you're not a new state. And that means that, of course, the internal rules and the internal legality can affect that determination.
So it's a little bit like an international legal scavenger hunt. If Vladimir Putin wants Crimea in Russia, he's got to collect this referendum on Sunday to give him sort of democracy cover. Then he's got to collect some other nation to recognize Crimea. He takes that to the international community. Game over.
Well, yes, although he's tried that before. So we do have these examples of the two enclaves in Georgia, Abkhazia and South Ossetia, where Russia encouraged a kind of local breakaway movement and eventually went in and intervened militarily in both places. And those little enclaves are recognized as independent countries by, I think, five states. But that's not enough to get them into, let's say, the United Nations or if they wanted the European Union or something like that. It is enough practically on the ground, because one of those five nations is Russia, and Russia will defend them and, you know, give them all the accoutrement of being a state, even if no one else around the world recognizes them.
So this plays then at this point, unless there is some military intervention, like the situation in Cyprus, which is divided between a Turkish Cyprus and a Greek Cyprus.
Yes, it might end up being like that. And of course, that has been long running dispute in the international community. These problems don't necessarily get better over time.
What's the advantage for Putin to push some kind of a stalemate? I mean, the fact that the Russian Navy is stationed at Sevastopol suggests that this is a little bit different in that it's a much higher stakes game for Russia because their Navy's right there.
Well, that's right. Russia has genuine interest there. They've had longstanding interest there, and that certainly is conditioning our diplomatic reaction to the crisis. It doesn't mean that they, you know, have the right to break away the republic, but it does mean that they are going to have to be part of a long-term solution. I know that some suggestion has been to sort of one way to de-escalate this is to encourage a kind of demilitarization or having the Ukraine government effectively step back completely from this region while retaining it as part of a region of the Ukraine.
So, Professor Ginsberg, looking at the Israeli situation, Israel annexed East Jerusalem and its closest ally, the United States, was completely opposed to that. Israel annexed the Golan Heights. There was also widespread opposition, yet it essentially happened because nobody could really do anything about it. Crimea is right next to Russia.
Right. I think that you know, no one is going to be able to do anything about this, either in a, you know, in a military way, certainly. And the difference, I suppose, with the Israeli situation is that the population that ends up being, an extra allied with Russia, it seems to really want that. It's not a situation of a hostile occupation, as you might say about East Jerusalem and possibly the Golan Heights. And so it's an even easier case, I suppose, than that. You know, force matters a lot in international law. Moral authority matters, too. And that we're seeing the two come together and in conflict quite starkly in this crisis.
What are the ripples throughout Europe? I mean, Angela Merkel described this as a potential disaster for Russia. We've had economic commentators on the program saying that the entanglement of Russia and its billionaire oligarchs with the Western economy constrains Russia. What do you think?
Well, it's not clear that the Europeans are going to react very strongly. They've been relatively softer in their language than the United States. They also have a lot of at stake in terms of their interdependence with Russia. So I'm not sure there's going to be long-term ripples. There weren't very many long-term ripples from Abkhazia and South Ossetia. So it seems like it may be something he can get away with. The job for him is to reassure other regions that this isn't going to continue to happen in terms of greater Russia.
Well, the Crimeans vote on Sunday. Putin seems to be sitting pretty. Tom Ginsburg is professor of international law at the University of Chicago. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com.
There's still no plane. The mystery of Flight 370 from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing continues.
MH370 went completely silent whilst over the open ocean. We are in the middle of a multinational search involving many countries and more than 80 ships and aircraft.
As you can hear, Malaysian officials still have no idea what has happened, and Chinese authorities, according to Jennifer Pak, BBC Malaysia correspondent, have only added to the confusion.
The thing is, we have so little facts, but here is what we know. We know that the flight left from Kuala Lumpur early Saturday morning, heading towards Beijing. About 2 hours into the flight, it lost contact with air traffic control. And at that time, the last point of contact would have been somewhere between the stretch of sea between Malaysia and Vietnam in the South China Sea. That's where the search effort was for a while. Then the military radar records apparently suggested that perhaps the plane was trying to turn back, meaning it was heading in the west direction. So now the Malaysian authorities have widened this search area vastly by going all the way to Western Peninsula, down the Straits of Malacca, all the way up to the Andaman Sea.
Meanwhile, China seems to have complicated matters. The question of military satellites, satellite images, and the question of even whether those releases of information were intentional.
Let me walk you through what happened. Initially, they released these satellite images on a government website. Now, that is always intentional in China because no information ever comes out without approval from senior ministers, especially through government channels. These images were satellite images that were taken one day after the plane went missing, and it showed three large objects that were quite big, and it was located east of Malaysia and south of Vietnam, which puts it roughly in the same vicinity, at least it's in the South China Sea. So they dispatched an aircraft from Malaysia to go and investigate. And that's when a lot of media outlets were very interested in it, because although we have been receiving time and time again reports of debris, every single possibility is still a sign of hope of some sense that this could at least bring some closure for the families who are suffering. But then during the press conference, the acting transport minister came out and denied this and said that he received a notice from the Chinese embassy apologizing and saying that they, in fact, should not have released those images, that it was a mistake, and that the debris that they caught on the satellite imagery had nothing to do with the aircraft itself. Nothing more. We got no more explanation from that. But from our Beijing colleagues, apparently in the evening news bulletin, they're still running the satellite images trying to connect it to a possibility of it being parts of the aircraft.
Is there a consensus among victims about what they believe has happened, even if it's as incomplete as you say?
Well, there are lots of conspiracy theories ruling around, but here's what Malaysian police have said. They're looking into possibilities that the plane itself was hijacked, that it was sabotaged. And also, in their words, they believe it could possibly have disappeared due to the psychological and personal problems of the people on board. They didn't really elaborate on what that could be, but those are the possibilities. Similarly, the Civil Aviation Department are also looking at possibilities of mechanical failure. Earlier on, there was concern about two passengers that boarded on the plane with stolen European passports. It seems at least one of them, anyways, according to Malaysian officials, was doing so because he was trying to seek asylum in Germany. So certainly it has dampened the theory about terrorism being the cause of it, but certainly hasn't pushed it away. So where are we on day six? No better off than we were when the plane went missing.
Jennifer Pak, BBC Malaysia correspondent in Kuala Lumpur. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you very much.
We are the pioneers, and we are going to be the one who set the stage for the rest of the sport.
Well, the one thing you can count on is absolutely nothing.
You never let your guard down and always play hard as you can play.
This is the home stretch right here. One more feature to navigate.
You know, just got to go with what you got.
This isn't just about skiing.
An all-out fight to the finish.
There's no such thing as can't.
Pushing it till the end, and he's got another gold medal.
Our Paralympics profile today is a curler in a wheelchair, and you would be hard-pressed to find a jollier or more experienced competitor than James Joseph. The Sochi Paralympics is likely the final bow on the world stage for this 51-year-old athlete. 4 years ago in Vancouver, Team USA placed fourth in curling, just missing a medal, and they're out of it already in Sochi. But just before the games began, James Joseph shared how meaningful this competition is for him and how much the sport of curling has done for his life as a disabled man.
I'm very proud to represent our country, USA, and I wear it on my arm. I have a tattoo, and I wear it well, and I'm very proud to do this. And I believe this is our year for my team to come home with a medal.
You went from 8th to 4th in your last two Paralympics. What's it going to take to put you over the top here?
It's a game of strategy, which is unbelievable. Once people really figure out and learn the game, they're like, wow, this is really not that easy as I thought it was. When an individual gets involved in a sport, it just grabs you. It's just so intriguing. It's so interesting. It's strategy beyond your wildest dreams. You know, it's just, I love this game. I'll be doing this another 20, 30 years, and I'm 51 years old now. So it's something that I thought I'd never in my wildest dreams be doing for this long, and taking me Italy, Sweden, Switzerland, Vancouver, Czech Republic, South Korea, now Russia. It's just, it's an amazing thing. I love it, and I'm not going to stop doing it. It's in my blood.
That's great to hear. And you're a double amputee, is that right?
Yes, I am a double amputee above the knee, yep.
You believe that the able-bodied curlers are kind of wusses for using the sweepers. I mean, you guys, what you do is harder, right?
Oh, it's definitely harder. It's basically muscle memory for us. When you do a takeout, it's a lot harder of a throw. And then your next shot could be a draw, which is a much softer, delicate throw. And there's where your muscle memory comes in and all your hard practice. Team chemistry is a huge thing to do with curling.
And where'd you come up with the name, or where'd you get the name Jimmy Jam?
Jimmy Jam. Well, I used to work at a printing shop with my brother-in-law, and I had music, and I was always, you know, jamming to the music. That name stuck with me ever since.
So if there was one song that you could play in the rink during the competition that would give you an advantage, what do you think it would be?
I think it'd be Queen. We are the champions.
You're such a sentimental guy, Jane. Such a softy. I figured you'd do some sort of Guns N' Roses kind of thing or something.
Well, you know, I could do that. I could do a little AC/DC too, you know. I could push a lot of music out there. It gets me pumping, like, you know. Like the Rocky, that's another good one.
Oh, you are such, you're so cheesy. Rocky, of course, of course.
Dun, 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 you know, coming out there. Yo, Adrian, you know, I did it.
Well, James, you know, good luck to you. Who are you most worried about in the competition?
Well, you can't take any team lightly. That's one thing you cannot do. That doesn't fly in curling. You just take every game as if, you know, every team's the best team out there.
Now, I suspect your kid isn't a double amputee, right?
No, I have a six-year-old daughter.
What does she think of all this?
She thinks Daddy's the greatest. He rocks. And she said, Daddy, I love you so much. You come home with that gold. And I said, I'll try, honey. She goes, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, any color will make me happy. Even if you don't come home with a medal, Daddy, I still love you. And, you know, it tugs at my heartstrings. And I said, I'll try. And I cry sometimes. And I'm a very emotional guy. And it's just wonderful. My wife's behind me 100%. I have great support back home.
Well, you go get that medal and take it home to that little girl.
Let me tell you what, we have never been so ready in all my 10 years of curling. I've never felt so good about going after a medal. I've always went out there hoping we get a medal, but I know this year we're going to get a medal. I feel that positive.
James Joseph, you rock it now.
You got it. I'm going to, man. That's what I plan on doing.
It was a heartbreaking overtime loss to Great Britain that gave the U.S. a final 4 wins and 5 losses, knocking the U.S. and Jimmy Jam Joseph out of the Sochi medal competition.
Sound of silver, talk to me, makes you want to feel like a teenager until you remember the feelings of a real life emotional teenager. Then you think again.
Where exactly did teenagers come from?
It doesn't matter, it doesn't matter, it doesn't matter.
Why should you be the only one involved?
Well, far be it for me to tell you what to do.
Oh, are you going to preach? Do we have to listen to a sermon now?
Well, I'm only trying to tell him what you mean. You can't be idealistic all your life.
Actor James Dean in Rebel Without a Cause, screaming at his father, actor Jim Backus, the classic teenage angst movie from the 1950s. They're at the birthplace of teen culture.
Of all the world's youth, none are more fortunate by birthright and inheritance than the 21 million boys and girls between the ages of 16 and 24 who constitute one vast and glamorous society.
This is just one example of the rich archival material filmmaker Matt Wolff relied on in putting together his new documentary called Teenage. It's a film full of insights that come directly off our discussion this week of aging and increased life expectancy in our time. With the stretching out of lifespans, youth is stretched out. The teenage years were invented, Matt Wolff says, because suddenly there was a time to grow up where there hadn't been before. Wolff says it was the dawn of a completely new era in human culture, and that's no exaggeration.
You know, with the abolition of child labor, there was this second stage of life that emerged, and young people weren't going to the factory. They were getting into trouble, and people perceived youth as a social problem. And so all these questions were raised about their role in society.
And what did you find in the course of filming that teenagers typically do with their autonomy, that the idea of teenagerness has granted them?
Well, I mean, I think they rebel. And I think that I've developed a more nuanced idea about what rebellion looks like and what the political dimensions of that are like as well. The film kind of follows 4 central characters. One is Brenda Dean Paul. She was one of England's bright young people in the 1920s. She was like a Lindsay Lohan figure.
Mm-hmm. Brenda hit the scene in 1926. She was 19. She came from a broken home, longed to be famous. She played many parts, but the most convincing was her role as life and soul of the party.
The paparazzi took her photos. The public loved to hate her. Like a lot of youth, she's someone that we idealize and we condemn. Another character was Melita Mashman. She was a Hitler youth.
Melita Mashman was a typical middle-class girl. Her parents complained about the unemployment and poverty, but they didn't do a thing. Melita wanted action. So she joined the Hitler Youth.
And what intrigued me in the diary that was the basis for her story, Account Rendered, she talks about how joining the Hitler Youth was a form of rebellion against her parents' generation in Germany. And another character is Tommy Scheel. He was one of Germany's swing kids. His story particularly inspired me because it's where politics and pop culture really collide.
The Nazis hated swing. they banned all art and social dancing. Boys and girls were forbidden to mix.
Him and his friends smuggled American swing records and British fashion into Nazi-era Germany and would have underground dance parties. And the Gestapo eventually arrested them. They were, you know, doing what kids do, but it was a subversive form of rebellion.
In each of these cases, while rebellion is nuanced internally for these teens, it can, if you're in the right place at the right time, produce a huge impact. In the case of Simple Rebellion, Hitler Youth. Simple, let's have a party, it becomes a cultural movement.
Exactly. And I think oftentimes adults, and I'm guilty of this too, kind of disregard teenage rebellion as an emotional or a hormonal rite of passage. And I think that this history proves that there's a real political substance to it and that it's been a catalyst for change.
If human beings were able to extend the condition of adolescence, this idea that we're not formed yet, we haven't made all of our decisions, and it went on instead of 4 or 5 years, it went on for 2 decades. Would that make us more productive, more skeptical, more inclined to question authority, more democratic, more anarchistic?
No, I think it would be dysfunctional, and I think it is happening. I think more and more the second stage of life is becoming prolonged and the generation gap is closing. I think that stems from a larger cultural obsession with youth, the desire that people have to stay young forever, and I don't necessarily think that's super productive.
But there's a huge collision there because you talk to teens, they can't wait to get out of this mm-hmm. predicament. And then you talk to 40-year-olds and they're all, you know, yearning to return to the fetal position.
Exactly. Yeah, I think there's something very restless about being young because you're not allowed to self-determine at that stage. You're not totally in control of your life. So you spend a lot of time kind of imagining the future and a lot of creative and meaningful things come out of that. But I think, there's a desire to be an adult, to live life on your own terms. And I think adults, they have an ambivalent relationship to youth. They tend to idealize being young and want to stay young, but they tend to also condemn the younger generation.
So how do audiences view this film? I suspect that teenagers would naturally view your characters as heroes, but that older people would be inclined to view them as specimens or think of them as kind of adorable.
Well, I think young people do feel empowered by the history in the film. It is a kind of call to arms for youth that really isn't about the kind of conformist, apathetic teenagers. It's about exceptional youth. And I think highlighting those kinds of characters is inspiring for young people.
Is there pressure among teens today to be exceptional, that simply going along, being in a group, growing up simply and for that reason alone is not enough?
Nowadays, as young people are facing kind of unprecedented unemployment and a lack of opportunities, that pressure feels even more intense. And with the advent of social media, I think people expect to get exceptional feedback on the ways that they express themselves. So many likes on Instagram or Facebook for every status update. You know, that's a very contemporary kind of pressure.
As a filmmaker who got to explore various decades of teenagerdom, is there a moment when you would have loved to have been a teenager based on what you looked at, even if it didn't make it into the film?
Yeah, I would have loved to be present for the jitterbugs and jitterbugging. I think it was just like really the first full-fledged subculture that had its own slang, style, music, dance, and it was something underground that young people were doing, and it became a mass media phenomenon. To be part of that explosion would have been amazing.
Matt, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Matt Wolff's new documentary, Teenage, opens in limited release tomorrow.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews. Now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com.
So here at the end of the hour, you made it through your teens, 20s, and 30s. How are you fixed for the other decades?
Hi, this is Anne Marie from Springfield, Missouri. And I am watching my parents in retirement. They're loving their late 60s, and I worry that I probably won't be able to retire till my 80s. So why don't we do a walkabout in our late 60s where we get a few years to relax and enjoy the beautiful things while we're able, and then we can go back to the workforce offering wisdom to others until we can no longer work.
Thanks for that advice, Anne Marie. As we've been talking about all week, an aging population changes everyone's plans. How are you fixed for your last act? From Steamboat Springs, Colorado, I would have to come up with a better plan for financing it, and I would only want to if I could remain in good health and active. I do like the idea, mainly because I'm in my 30s with no children. I'm nervous about not knowing my grandchildren well since I waited so long to start a family. Genomic life scientist J. Craig Venter talked about his initiative this week on The Takeaway to use gene science to stretch out the older years, developing preventive therapies that he says one day will be accessible to everyone. But is the economy ready for all of this aging? Courtney Coyle is associate professor of economics at Wellesley College. She looks at this precise question for the Knapp Social Science Center at Wellesley. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So help me to understand what happens economically as a sort of social question when lives extend. I can certainly understand that, you know, I need to plan more if I've got, you know, 6 decades ahead of me as opposed to 2 decades ahead of me. But broadly, what does it mean?
On the cost side, I think everyone's mind immediately goes to the expenditures on the elderly through the Social Security program, Medicare, and other programs like that, and the fact that longer life expectancies put greater pressure on those programs and therefore government finances. And that's well understood. But it's important, I think, to think of longer lifespans as representing an opportunity as well, that there's a contribution to society that comes from longer life. People have the ability to work longer, and that's a transition that we're already seeing. Rates of labor force participation at ages 65 and above for both men and women are higher than they've been over the last 15 or 20 years. They're trending up. Older people can help families. That's something a lot of people know from firsthand experience, take care of the grandchildren or do other things to relieve pressure on busy working families. And obviously, seniors have a lot of opportunities, a lot of potential to do volunteer work in their communities, whether that's as a docent in a museum, a tutor in a school, sort cans at a food pantry, and so on. So there's increasing evidence, too, that remaining active doing work or work-like activities has cognitive benefits for the individual as well. So I think there's a real possibility here for a rich and rewarding third act for the individual that has benefits for the society as well.
So lots to talk about there. Let's take that apart a little bit. I'm wondering that an aging population that is inclined to work longer is going to embrace retiring at a later age. And so all of a sudden, the controversy surrounding, making retirement later, changing Social Security's assumptions is just going to melt away by sheer strength of numbers of people living beyond their 70s and 80s.
I think it may be true that it's becoming easier to envision a way in which the system could be reformed to put it on better financial footing in the future, if only that when you look at Social Security, its problems seem to pale compared to those with Medicare and funding health care costs. And I think you're right that increasing the expectation of how many years people will work is likely to be part of the solution. As people, I'm sure, already know, the Social Security normal retirement age, that is the age at which you're entitled to the sort of regular 100% of your benefits, used to be 65. It's currently 66, and it's slated to rise to 67. That's based on changes that were already passed a long time ago. But there's talk about that increasing, you know, perhaps to as much as age 70, or perhaps being indexed to life expectancy so it would rise automatically. Because I think there is an appreciation that this is a program that was established in 1935. Life expectancy has increased greatly since then, and we can't necessarily expect to leave the structure of the benefit program exactly in place the way it was as we have these longer life expectancies. But there needs to be, you know, sort of a nuanced look at how that affects different subgroups of the population, because it's probably fair to say it's not equally easy for all workers to extend their work lives.
No, certainly, but the level of controversy surrounding whether we extend the retirement age to age 75 even seems to be declining precipitously. And as you refer to the assumptions that were made about the aging population in the 30s when Social Security was set up, the aging population was a fringe population in the 1930s. And today, the aging population is actually a central productive component of the workforce.
retirement itself is basically a fairly modern concept. If you go back to the late 1900s or the early 20th century, the fraction of people at ages 65 and above, 75 and above, you know, of those people who were still alive at those ages, very, very many of them were working, you know, something like three quarters or very high fractions, because it just simply wasn't any choice. People had to work to survive. You know, we live in a different era now. We have Social Security. We have pensions, we hope. We have other sources. We save for retirement. We have other ways of supporting ourselves in retirement. And so retirement has become a luxury that we've been able to afford as our society has gotten richer. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we can afford to spend an ever increasing share of our lifespan in that period of retirement.
I know people who actually start their working life with an idea of when they're going to retire, and that's completely unheard of. That's beyond a luxury. That's almost a mainstream consideration. Retirement is almost one of the first things you think about when you join the workforce.
It is something that people think about and plan for. And I think, you know, as we face it, realities of, again, rising healthcare costs and more years of retirement to fund because of this rising life expectancy, for those people who are able to do so, probably the smartest thing you can do if you get to, say, being in your 60s, the smartest thing you can do from a financial point of view to set yourself up for greater financial success in retirement is to extend that work life by a number of years if you can. For some people, that's staying at their existing job. For other people, it's transitioning to a so-called bridge job, maybe a job that offers reduced hours, more flexibility, less stress, something that might be more commensurate with the work experience the person's looking for at that point. But if people can continue in the labor force in one way or another, and importantly, if they can delay claiming those Social Security benefits, because I think people are aware of this, but it's important to realize that the monthly benefit amount you get depends in a very direct way on how old you are when you start that benefit. You can delay, under the current system, without any changes to it, you can delay the startup, the take-up of benefits all the way to age 70. And, you know, compared to someone who would have been eligible for $1,000 a month if they claimed at 66, that gets reduced to $750 a month if you claim at 62, and to over $1,300 a month if you claim at 70. So there's a lot of money on the table, you know, in terms of boosting your monthly income if you are able to wait until you begin drawing down Social Security.
Courtney Coyle, Associate Professor of Economics and Director of the Knapp Social Science Center at Wellesley College. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Nikki. I'm calling from Westport. And yes, I would love to live to be over 100. I enjoy life. It's a little too hard sometimes, but for the most part, worth the effort. And I'm very, very curious about what things will be like when I get to be really old.
And there's the question of where the new midpoint of life might be.
Hi, I'm Marianne. I come from Swansea, Massachusetts, and I work at South Coast Health System. I'm 63 years old. I'm an RN, and work is brutally physical. So no, I can't imagine that this is my midlife.
The confusing consequences of living in triple digits or imagining it. Leave your impressions of 21st century midlife or your embrace of longevity by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway or join the conversation at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation.
God bless our love.